The Battle for the Public Interest.
The rapid consolidation of media across broadcast, also into film, book publishing, created a situation where instead of having the democratic media system that the founders anticipated, with thousands of different owners of small weekly newspapers, you no longer had Tom Paine, you had Rupert Murdoch.
Rupert, is there any agenda that you want to shape? For example, take the war, you having a global media enterprise. I mean, have you shaped that agenda at all in terms of how the war is viewed?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've tried.
Tried in what way?
Well, we basically supported our papers and our television. I would say supported the Bush policy.
News Corp and others have eaten out nearly every single independently managed newspaper within the United States. That is something that is quite dangerous, and putting its business interests and its political interests over the top of all that.
In order to prevent media monopolies, the Federal Communications Commission was charged with regulating the media.
The most important job the FCC has is looking out for regular citizens and making sure that whatever media policy is made, that it's the best for the public and the best for democracy.
How are you?
Good. Good to see you. I'm available for questions.
So, Colin Powell leads the drumbeat for war, and his son Michael Powell was attempting to lead the war against diversity of voices at home.
Once in office, Powell waged war against the last remaining rules on media ownership.
Here is this agency that very few people knew about, and they were trying to push through regulations that said, in a town, the newspaper, radio, and television could be owned by one person, by a media mogul, someone like Rupert Murdoch.
This was what people feared the most, that all the content for TV, radio, and the newspaper coming out of one shop, a one-size-fits-all, one-newsroom community.
There was almost no public scrutiny until Michael Powell called network coverage of the Iraq War thrilling.
There were these millions of people, and they hear that the FCC guy is calling the coverage thrilling while he's trying to obliterate the last remaining rules, and it just tapped into this anger that people were feeling about the war.
Despite millions of people protesting against the FCC, Michael Powell didn't get the message.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Even when people did say, hey, FCC, we're the public, we don't want you to do this, the FCC turned around and did exactly what those mega corporations wanted it to do in the first place.
With victory at hand, the media giants publicly expressed their gratitude.
And it was pretty stunning. The head of Viacom is Sumner Redstone. He repeatedly said, having a Republican in the White House is better for my company, and I vote Viacom. And for that reason, I endorse Bush's election.
These large conglomerate companies, they contribute to political campaigns. They expect to get something for their money. Deciding on their own and for their own purposes, the news we see and hear.
The big five conglomerates control the majority of media in the USA. General Electric, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and News Corporation. James Murdoch, chief executive of News Corporation, tells us what his company stands for.
There's an inescapable conclusion that we must reach if we are to have a better society.
Well, if you're just waking up with us.
The only reliable, durable, and perpetual guarantor of independence is profit. Thank you.
Danny Glover, actor and director.
Every aspect of our lives, from what we buy, what is sold to us, who produces it, all those things are connected. It's not only a monopoly of wealth, it's a monopoly of information as well.
The Silence. Brad Friedman, journalist.
This is the mother of all scandals. International finance, nuclear weapons, spying. And yet, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, all of them, apparently couldn't give a damn about the story.
In the wake of 9/11, the media focused its attention on terrorism.
The threat of nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists is real.
Sibel Edmonds, FBI language specialist for a brief period following the September 11th attacks. A dirty
bomb. This was about 4 or 5 days after the September 11 terrorist attack when the FBI was asking people with language abilities to join the Bureau.
Philip Giraldi, CIA counterterrorism officer from 1976 to 92.
Sibel Edmonds would have been listening to evidence of criminal activity, corruption issues.
You were there. Okay.
The FBI was also looking at proliferation of nuclear materials, weapons transfers, weapons sales that were illegal.
I think the marshals both have our
votes. One of the investigations by the FBI led toward Turkish groups involved in nuclear espionage.
What I was reviewing was not only in foreign language, a lot of them, in fact, were in English. It involved people from the State Department talking to the targets of these operations.
What Edmonds allegedly heard were conversations about the exchange of U.S. nuclear secrets between a Turkish group and Mark Grossman, a high-ranking State Department official.
Mark Grossman's conversation with the Turks was very definitely against U.S. interests. It also was a crime, because there were other conversations indicating that he had taken money from the Turks. So that is a clear issue of corruption in the U.S. government.
Edmonds discovered the alleged illegal sale of U.S. nuclear secrets.
She's talking about stolen secrets sold on the black market to, frankly, enemies of the U.S. Iran, Libya, North Korea, potentially even Al-Qaeda. This is happening in the highest level of the U.S. government.
When she reported her discovery to the heads of the FBI, their reaction was unexpected.
The assistant director of the FBI coming and boldly asking not to report this any further, that this was explosive, and just asking me to forget and move on.
When she continued to raise questions at the FBI, Edmonds was fired with no explanation.
So you're firing me without providing me with any reasons? And the response was, no, we're not firing you, we're terminating you. There's a big difference.
She took the FBI to court for wrongful termination, and the administration responded by silencing her under law.
This absurd state secrets privilege is absolute. And it requires no evidence.
At that point, I thought there will be no judge who would agree with this. I mean, this is ludicrous. Instead, the judges asked the security to come and escort me and my attorneys outside the court. And never got to hear the argument. Everything about this case is considered classified, highly sensitive, covered by the state secrets privilege. Me, including my name. In effect, I became this classified woman.
Edmonds turned to the media to report her exclusive story of alleged government corruption.
Sibel Edmonds, in a heartbeat, could have been scooped up, thrown in jail, and never heard from again. So it took, you know, no small bit of courage for her to come forward to try to get her story out.
I did not receive a single inquiry from the mainstream media here.
While the mainstream media remained silent, she received support from Daniel Ellsberg. Decades earlier, the press had published classified information he'd obtained revealing government corruption surrounding the Vietnam War.
Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers whistleblower.
Nixon's fear that I had more information to give led him to take a number of criminal actions to shut me up. This country needs whistleblowers like Sybil Edmonds if we're to hold these officials accountable.
I put her in touch with a couple of people. In each case, there was great excitement in what she had to say at the reporter level. They pursued it for a while. She had great discussion with them. And then suddenly, there would be an abrupt cutoff.
Her story made headlines around the world, but was not echoed in the mainstream press in the United States.
There are many examples where a story is huge all over the world, except in the United States. Even if they're reported, they don't hit the media echo chamber. And stories don't have much impact unless they get into the echo chamber.
What happens is that people call up some of the top newspapers, get them off the story, and having done that, the other papers follow the lead of silence.
We are going to see less and less of whistleblowers because each example set, like myself, is a lesson learned for those people who may be planning to come and do the right thing.
To this day, no mainstream news organization in the United States has investigated Edmonds' claim of nuclear espionage by American officials.
Who's actually doing the censoring? Is it the media themselves? Is it the government? I don't know. But if it didn't appear in the New York Times, Washington Post, AP, it never happened.
This country wasn't set up to have a government of, by, and for media conglomerates. Democracy needs those diverse competing voices. The consolidation of media has robbed us of that diversity. In many cases, we have no voices. Whole areas of government and politics and power going dark.
The Public Voice.
In 2007, with the FCC reviewing its media ownership rules, the public came forward.
Millions of people wrote to Congress, wrote to the FCC, emailed, spoke out at forums. You'd have a forum of 1,000 people. This was unheard of, saying no. One media mogul can't own the radio, television, and newspaper in a city.
Here was an example where the public had intervened and gummed something up.
Under new chairman Kevin Martin, the FCC announced public hearings on media ownership in cities across the U.S.
We are some of the most entertained people on the planet, but we don't know a lot about what's going on in the world because of the way our public media is structured. Four companies control 86% of Portland's media market. That is not diverse. It is not competitive. Certainly not where you are.
Our culture is being criminalized by the radio station, and I beg the FCC to help us.
We don't have news anymore. It's all entertainment.
On every channel, you can switch from channel to channel and see the same thing.
NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox do not serve the people.
That's consolidated media.
All you have is the same 10-song playlist, whether you're in New York, Oklahoma.
Certain channels spend more time on plastic surgery than the war in Iraq.
So some Wizard of Oz tells us what is news.
The States of America may as well be called the United Corporations of America.
It's very clear that this country has become profits over people.
Despite overwhelming public opinion against more consolidation, Kevin Martin sided with the media conglomerates and removed the cross-ownership ban.
The public hearings were more a dog and pony show than an actual opportunity to see if this is something that the public wanted.
What Kevin Martin did was demonstrate his absolute thoroughgoing contempt for doing his job and representing the public interest. Embracing entirely the interest of wealthy corporate benefactors, period. Pure and simple.
On the 7th of July 2011, a Federal's appeal court overturned Kevin Martin's cross-ownership rule that allowed one company to own the newspaper, radio and television in one town. The court said the FCC had breached the public interest. In spite of the court's decision, News Corporation has held a waiver of the cross-ownership rule since 1993 and continues to monopolize media outlets.
The international commerce got bigger and bigger. The View began to prevail. What's the big deal about news? What's all this talk about public service? Baloney. We're in the entertainment business.
As TV networks chased profits, NBC News sought to exploit the internet by blurring the line between news and entertainment.
Anyone watching this scene repeat itself over and over might be wondering what's going on.
Douglas McCollum, journalist in the Columbia Journalism Review.
NBC's Catch a Predator was ostensibly a news program, and when they saw that it was a ratings winner, they really began to push it and produce more and more and more of these shows that really blur the line between reality television and news department. And it's really sort of car wreck television.
NBC launched To Catch a Predator, a news program featuring undercover sting operations that exposed men seeking sex with minors.
Walter Weiss, Detective Murphy Police Department, 2002 to 2007.
NBC came into the area. They selected a house. And in that house, they set up computers, they set up cameras, basically set up a stage in which they could lure a criminal to over an internet.
In the autumn of 2006, with the help of local police, NBC News set up one of its undercover stings in a small town in Texas.
The kinds of places they choose are smaller police departments who don't have the resources to mount these kind of very ambitious sting operations. But for the fact of NBC News, police wouldn't be there. There wouldn't be any arrests. There wouldn't be any police officers taking down these suspects.
NBC had contracted an actor who was at the time either 21 or 22 years old, but he looked much younger. And his photo had been used as this guy who had presented himself as a 13-year-old boy.
With a new Dateline Netcrime to catch.
The program lured 20 men to the sting house. But NBC News really only had one man in mind.
When they discovered that they had an assistant district attorney on the hook, that there was a real sense of excitement. This was going to be good for the show.
Bill was always the egghead in the firm that knew the answer to every question. And Bill was scary bright. He loved his parents and loved his family, and that and his law practice were the two pinnacles of importance in his life.
They had tried very aggressively to get him to come. They kept urging him to come. Why aren't you coming over? Things like that.
To the disappointment of NBC News, Conrad never showed up at the sting house.
It's the final day of shooting, and Luke still hasn't managed to get Bill Conrad to actually show up at the decoy house.
With the NBC News deadline looming, the show did something it had never done before.
Ultimately, in order to get to Bill Conrad, they decided to basically bring the show to him.
Mr. Hansen appeared to be in charge. He would ask for things, and he was immediately accommodated.
524-2849.
It certainly looked like a case where the cops were doing what they were doing as agents of a television company.
NBC News and the police waited in front of Conrad's house for hours, hoping to confront him on camera.
He was at the office every day like clockwork. They could have just come, tapped him on the shoulder, and taken him in. This was all done as part of a need to get it on film for a television show.
With Conrad staying put, police broke with procedure and called in a SWAT team with NBC News cameras rolling.
They forced their way into the house. They encountered Mr. Conrad in the hallway holding a handgun. At which point he raised the gun and shot himself in the head and killed himself.
What can you tell us about the scene?
It's just a gunshot wound to the head.
There's nothing wrong with a sting operation. There's nothing wrong with taking criminals off the street, provided you're doing it for the right reason. If you're luring them there because you want a television show, well, then you're wrong.
The way these folks pulled off their maneuver and shocked and startled Bill Conrad, they could have handled it with so much more dignity. You'll never convince me that that was a service to our community.
Well, I sat down and talked with Chris Hansen following Mr. Conrad's suicide. He was not overly apologetic about what had happened. In fact, he said, "I sleep well at night."
NBC News broadcast the program during prime time, despite Conrad's death.
The American public knows far more information about sex scandals, celebrities, Hollywood, than they know about economics and the environment. That's by design. I think the people that own the media would be much happier if we were a nation of mindless consumers rather than a nation of informed active citizens.
The last shadow of liberty.
To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. That starts with an open internet. I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality. Because once providers start to privilege...
It's simple, it's net neutrality, it's non-discrimination, and it's a basic principle that politicians pay lip service to it. That if these same players like AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner are able to take over the internet through lax public policy, that we'll lose even the internet.
Despite his election promises, President Obama has brought in new internet pricing rules going against the principles of a free and open internet.
It is by making publishing cheap that permits many more people to become publishers, that permits many more different voices. That's where the internet has really excelled. WikiLeaks has published a lot of information about war, about militaries, how they behave, intelligence organizations, and that information often comes as a surprise to the public. It's because the public has been lied to.
Come on, fire!
We have moved the envelope for what is acceptable for people to publish.
Joe Biden, U.S. Vice President.
Stop Mr. Assange. We're looking at that right now.
Mr. Connell says he's a high-tech terrorist. Others say this is akin to the Pentagon Papers. What do you come
back? I would argue that it's closer to being a high-tech terrorist than the Pentagon Papers.
The greatest fight we have had in bringing the First Amendment to the world was in bringing the First Amendment to the United States.
This guy's a traitor, a treasonous, and he has broken every law in the United States. The guy ought to
the
be...
The question is, what's going to happen now? Will the internet remain free? Or will a few companies be able to control and monetize it? That's the debate of the era.
If we are to address the most fundamental issues of the 21st century, we have to stop, recognize that our media is in crisis, and ask ourselves, what is the media that we want?
We want more information, access to more information. We have fewer people who control the information.
You can't allow this country to go down for the count because some guys on Wall Street can't make money producing garbage news.
The media is that kind of issue where if we want it to be better, we have to fight for it.
These are the critical battles we face right now in the United States and, frankly, in countries around the world. How we respond to this moment will be every bit as definitional as how the founders responded to their moment.
This is really about having a conversation about what kind of decisions we want made in our name. That's really what will save us, is when we really know what's going on, not filtered through the lens or the microphone of a corporation.
There's a quote from Malcolm X. The media's the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent, and that's power, because they control the minds of the masses. And the film is dedicated to Ben Bagdikian, whose work The New Media Monopoly inspired it. There's a quote from Noam Chomsky. The United States is unusual amongst the industrial democracies in the rigidity of its system of ideological control. Indoctrination, we might say, exercised through the mass media. And there's a quote from billionaire media mogul and founder of CNN, Ted Turner. We have to do more than keep media giants from growing larger. They're already too big. We need a new set of rules that will break these huge companies to pieces. And the film has a website at shadowsofliberty.org. This would seem to be the perfect point at which to talk about the other project on the internet that takes up quite a lot of my time, apart from this radio show. It's called WikiSpooks, and I discovered it when I was researching the show. If you're a fan of the show, you might be interested in WikiSpooks. It's an open source encyclopedia, like Wikipedia, uses the same software, but doesn't have the same editorial policy, so it doesn't assume, for example, that because governments say it, it's very likely to be true. Also, doesn't have the same policy on notability. Wikipedia says, basically, if it's not in newspapers or on television, then it didn't happen. That's very convenient for people who can keep things out of the news, because they can also keep them out of Wikipedia. And a lot of well-meaning people think, because they're not clued up to how commercially controlled media works, that if it wasn't reported on the newspapers, the television, then it's obviously nonsense. So reliability assumes that if it is in the newspaper or on the television, then it's a reliable source. Now, yes, we know that TV can legally lie on news programs. That seems to have passed these guys by. So, Wikipedia, great idea, and when it started, it was some kind of organized chaos, worked very well. But in the last 7 years, it's increasingly professionalized. These days, it's more or less the guardian of the official narrative. There are PR companies. There are people who spend their whole day making sure Wikipedia pages look the way that people at the top of hierarchies would like them to look. So, alternative, cruise over to WikiSpooks and edit away. If you're a regular listener to the show and a fan, you're probably exactly the sort of person whose ideas could really help the encyclopedia. It would help if you've got a systematic approach, if you're good with computers, if you've edited Wikipedia, fantastic, you've got all the skills you need. And if you just got enthusiasm, then email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, or join up on the site, wikispooks.org. I'll link it in from this show's webpage. It's not very difficult to learn how to do this. It's just time for another quick commercial. My effort to help people use Wikipedia to get out of commercially controlled media. It's called Wikipedia Plus. I did talk about it on the show a couple of years back. I've improved the software since then. It was quite slow when I originally coded it. But if you're a user of Firefox and you'd like an automatic link from Wikipedia pages to unwelcome guests, then that's what the software provides. So there's a couple of thousand pages which are cross-referenced. and it also cross-references WikiSpooks and a bunch of other sites, and is customizable, so if you've got your own sites, then it can cross-link those. Now, with no further ado, here is some frankly pretty distressing stuff. This is an excerpt of a speech by Jeremy Scahill on his new book and film, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, about the reality of war that the commercially controlled media works so hard to hide from the people whose taxes go to fund it. The speech was made on the 30th of October 2013, and this extract is courtesy of the Radio Project, that's radioproject.org. It was broadcast in January 2014.
For me, we saw how low things have gotten in our media culture the week of the, and I'm sorry that I even know this, the Jodi Arias verdict came down. Jodi Arias, of course, was this young, beautiful Mormon woman, Mormon convert, who had killed her boyfriend. And like CNN, it was like the second coming of the Gulf War, except it was just a trial. They had like Wolf Blitzer, and the whole team was deployed in multiple locations across the country to get reaction, and they're covering all the angles and who's wearing what and what kind of makeup, and they have analysis of Jodi Arias' face from these, you know, advanced degreed people who know about facial recognition stuff. And all. I mean, it was a ridiculous story. It was like, I called it Nancy Grace Christmas. You know, it was just completely insane. So that week, you have CNN just doing gavel-to-gavel coverage of this one murder trial of this Mormon woman who butchered her boyfriend in the shower. And that same week, CNN quietly announces that they were closing their Baghdad bureau in Iraq. You know, CNN, the world leader in news, is their slogan with the James Earl Jones gravitas and, you know, CNN. So they closed the Baghdad bureau. They cover the hell out of the Jodi Arias trial. Baghdad is burning. It's a country that we destroyed, completely destroyed. If you look at Iraq today, there are suicide bombings daily. There are cafes being blown up. Women have never been in modern history in Iraq in a worse position than they are today in that country. And the U.S. talks about we need to intervene in Syria, which is Iraq's neighbor, which is home to hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees. And no one seems to make that connection anymore. We did this. And I say we because American taxpayer dollars went to fund it, journalists didn't ask the right questions, and then they allowed their media outlets to be used, as Amy Goodman says, as conveyor belts for the lies of an administration. And we have this dark period of 8 years with Bush and Cheney in power. And then you have Obama come along. And it was like it just sucked all of the wind and energy out of the anti-war movement. And Obama presents himself and is presented as this epic, transformative figure in the history of American politics. The guy who's going to roll back all of the things that Bush and Cheney did. The constitutional lawyer. The first African-American president. A guy who came out and said, I'm going to close Guantanamo. I'm going to end torture. I'm going to restore the rule of law. He projected this image to the public. And then he gets into office. He's elected. And within 3 days of being elected, he does two things. One is he signs a series of executive orders that his administration portrayed as dismantling the Bush-era torture apparatus. And two, he begins authorizing expanded drone strikes in Pakistan and an intensification of the war in Afghanistan. And those were the policies that I was most interested in. Not in the speeches that these people give, but in what their actions are. I don't care how Barack Obama treats Sasha and Malia. I care, I'm sure he's a great father. I care how he treats all of the other children around the world. For me as a journalist, that's what's relevant. So we started investigating early on the Obama administration's war policy. And what we saw was that there was a radical expansion of drone strikes in Pakistan, that in Afghanistan, he had tapped one of the darkest of the dark ops soldiers to run his war in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, who had run what was effectively Murder Incorporated under Bush and Cheney as commander of the elite commando unit known as the Joint Special Operations Command. He takes this guy in McChrystal, who was used to operating with almost no oversight, with carte blanche to hit in various countries around the world. They also ran torture centers in Iraq and elsewhere under JSOC, and he puts him in charge of an entire war. And what happened was that the conventional war, which we would see in public, embedded journalists, and we'd see water purification plants being built and the Marines, you know, traveling around Marja or elsewhere. There was another war. It was a secret war. It was the night raids. It was the drone strikes. It was the cruise missile attacks. And so we went to Afghanistan and we started to look at that war. Journalists are not allowed to go out with those units. Human rights groups can't follow up because there's no point of contact to ask about the raids. And we started to investigate a series of night raids that were happening in Afghanistan. And we stumbled across one because of the great work of a journalist named Jerome Starkey, who works for the Times of London, in this city called Gardez in Paktia province, which is an area of Afghanistan that is largely controlled by the Taliban and the Haqqani Networks forces. The Haqqani Networks were recently designated a terror organization by the State Department, and they're tied to Pakistan's ISI intelligence services. And this night raid that had happened in this place, Gardez, took place when U.S. commandos went to a home in the middle of the night, and they positioned snipers on the walls. The people inside of the home were having a celebration to name a child who had been born 6 days earlier. And they're dancing, and they're doing the most un-Taliban-like activities. Men and women mingling together, women not wearing head cover, music being played. They were having a party. So these American commandos go and they position themselves. The people inside of this party consist of a man who is a senior Afghan police commander who had been trained by the United States, his brother who was a prosecutor working for the U.S.-backed Afghan government. They were not ethnic Pashtuns, the almost exclusive ethnicity of the Taliban. If anything, they were the quintessential example of the kind of people the United States wanted to be working with in Afghanistan, and it actually convinced that it was in their interest to work with the U.S. So these soldiers are there outside the compound. Inside the compound, they hear rustling. One of the guys, the men of the house, who is the police commander, named Mohammed Daoud, steps out into the courtyard and is immediately shot by a sniper. Women and men and children start screaming inside of the house. They hear voices in English outside. And his brother, who was a prosecutor, spoke English. And he said, I'm going to go and try to talk to them. This is a mistake. And he is grabbed by some of the women in the house, and they're saying, don't go out there, they're going to kill you. And he said, no, I'm going to appeal to them. And he says, you know, I'm a prosecutor. The person you just shot is a police commander. We work for the government. This is a mistake. He's saying to them in English. He steps through a doorway and is shot himself. And then the women start going to grab his body, and three women are then shot. Two of the women were pregnant. So you have three women who were shot, an Afghan police commander, and a prosecutor who works for the U.S.-backed Afghan government. The U.S. commandos then descend on the scene. They take the women into one room. They take the men into another. They begin interrogating them. And they realize over the course of their initial investigation that they have screwed up. They believed that what they were doing was hitting a house that was being used by the Taliban to create suicide bombers and to make improvised explosive devices. They had bad intelligence, and they go there that night and they do this. And it's sickening, but this happens all the time in Afghanistan. If you talk to anyone who's been deployed and has been involved with these night raids, this happens. Maybe the families get paid some money for the loss of their loved ones. They get some kind of an apology, and the Americans move on. And the way that it's written off in the U.S. is that this stuff happens in war. These aren't war crimes. This happens. Well, in this particular case, the men who did the killing, the American men who did the killing, decided that they wanted to cover up their actions. So in full view of the surviving husbands of the pregnant women, they dig the bullets out of the women's bodies so that there's no evidence of American rounds there. They then bound and gag the women, and they put word up their chain of command that they had stumbled across an honor killing and that the women were actually killed by members of their own family. And later they tried to kind of adjust it and say it was actually a Taliban honor killing. And they had taken all of the men of the house, handcuffed them, put them on an aircraft, and flown them to another province and held them there for 3 days interrogating them, trying to come up with evidence that they actually were Taliban or had some tangential connection to the Taliban. And nothing could have been further from the truth. In fact, the other day, we got an email at our Dirty Wars site from an American soldier who knew Mohammed Daoud, this Afghan police commander who was the first person killed. And he said, I just saw your film. And I am in shock. I knew Mohammed Daoud. I worked with Mohammed Daoud. He fought alongside us against the Taliban his entire career, working with the U.S. The fact that they would say that he was Taliban is just shocking to me. So you have the situation where they lie up the chain of command, and then it's co-signed by everyone else going up. And when journalists went to investigate this and get the family side of it, the NATO forces accused the journalists of lying. And it was only because of tenacious reporting that we discovered that the people that had done this raid were members of the Joint Special Operations Command, the most elite unit in the entire U.S. national security apparatus. Now JSOC is world famous. Most people know it probably as SEAL Team 6, although that also is, they're not called SEAL Team 6 anymore, but that's the way it's referred to in the press, because they were the guys that heroically killed an elderly man in his bedroom in Abbottabad, Pakistan, who was not armed at all, who admittedly was an atrocious international mass murderer who should have been put on trial, but nonetheless they shot an unarmed elderly man in the face in his bedroom. And this image of them is projected to the world, and Disney tries to trademark SEAL Team 6 so that they can market action figures and movies. They lost the trademark battle, but they tried to do it. And there's this whole glorification of the warrior culture in our society. But before that happened, before bin Laden was killed by JSOC, we were investigating a series of incidents that almost never made it into the U.S. media. These are guys digging bullets out of the corpses of pregnant women and then saying that they had stumbled across a Taliban honor killing and sort of acted as though they were heroic in stopping more damage from taking place that day. And the reason that we know that they were from JSOC is because about a month after these killings happen, an extraordinary event takes place where a convoy of Afghan soldiers and Americans pull up in this village of Kataba in Gardez in Paktia province, and they have sheep with them on a flatbed truck. And they offload these sheep and pull out a blade and offer to sacrifice the sheep to ask for forgiveness for doing these killings. And among the Americans that were there that day was a man named Admiral William McRaven, who at the time was the commander of JSOC. Admiral William McRaven was an original member of SEAL Team 6 in the 1980s and was the key person from the U.S. military that developed the Bush administration's assassination program in the early days after 9/11. He shows up in the middle of nowhere Afghanistan with sheep offering to sacrifice them. At this point, Admiral McRaven's identity was classified, as was the existence of JSOC. We start to then research who this guy is, who JSOC is, and realize that this isn't just a group of elite commandos. This is effectively a paramilitary wing of the White House. And they were designed in 1980 to be the go-to force for presidents who wanted to have a team that draws the best soldiers from every unit of the military that could be used in discrete operations that the U.S. could later deny. So why would a powerful force like this, incredibly empowered by the White House, be kicking down the doors on a family in the middle of Gardez, Afghanistan? What we thought was going to be an investigation into Obama's secret war in Afghanistan soon became a global investigation. We were tracing the story of JSOC, and we were tracing the story of what they were doing under President Obama. And we started to look at places where there were questionable strikes, where it was unclear if the U.S. was responsible or someone else. And we started focusing on Yemen. Because in December of 2009, President Obama authorized the beginning of a bombing campaign by the U.S. in Yemen. But it was not designed to be an overt bombing campaign. The idea, and this plot was hatched in meetings between General David Petraeus and the dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh. And the plan was that the U.S. is going to start bombing Yemen, but the Yemeni government is going to take responsibility for the strikes. And Yemen will publicly say our air forces did these bombings. So the first strike that Obama authorizes is on December 17, 2009. They got intelligence from the ground, most likely from either the Saudis or from someone within Yemeni intelligence, that there was an al-Qaeda training camp in this village of al-Majla in the south of Yemen in Abyan province, and that there was a senior al-Qaeda leader who was in this training camp. And they present the president, JSOC and the CIA present the president with an urgent request. We have these people in our sights. We need to take them out now. They wanted to use drones, but all of the drones were deployed to Pakistan at the time to be bombing Pakistan. So instead they authorize a cruise missile attack with the use of cluster bombs. So they launch these cruise missiles on what they claim is an al-Qaeda training facility, and they blow up everyone in this area. The Yemeni government then issues a press release saying that Yemeni forces have conducted airstrikes against an Al-Qaeda training camp and killed 34 Al-Qaeda terrorists and completely immobilized the training camp, obliterated it. The White House then sends a note of congratulations to the Yemeni government, praising them for their actions against Al-Qaeda. And that was sort of the story. But then a Yemeni journalist named Abdullah Haider Shaya goes to Al-Majla right after the bombing. And tribal leaders from throughout Yemen go to the aftermath of the bombing right afterwards. And they took photos and videos. And when I went to Yemen, I was there multiple times to investigate this, I obtained all of those videos and all of those photos. And what they showed was a massacre. There were 36 women and children that were killed that day. And we have the names of every single one of them. You saw limbs of children scattered around. One tribal leader who went there and helped to try to bury the dead said, when we were trying to bury them, we couldn't separate what was animal meat from human meat. We didn't know what to bury. We didn't know what we were burying. And they took pictures of the missiles. And plain for everyone to see who would go there, the words were written on the missiles, made by General Dynamics, USA. Yemen does not have cruise missiles. Yemen does not have cluster bombs. The White House knowingly issued a fraudulent letter of congratulations to Yemen, taking responsibility for what was a unilateral U.S. strike with absolutely no Yemeni military involvement whatsoever. And far from destroying an Al-Qaeda camp, they blew up a Bedouin village. Now, the White House has never, never provided an answer as to why they targeted the village that day. When I eventually went there and interviewed the survivors, one of the surviving tribal leaders from this area, this is an illiterate Bedouin tribe. We met with people who had never heard of the United States when we went there. And we interviewed girls whose whole families had been killed. And we interviewed this one tribal leader, and I asked him, what is your response to the White House saying that the people killed here were Al-Qaeda? And he said to me, you've been looking at all of the photos. You've been talking to these orphans. You've seen the injuries on those of us that survived. If they kill children and call them Al-Qaeda, then we're all Al-Qaeda. If you kill children and call them terrorists, then we're all terrorists. They don't even know who they're killing in many of these places. You know, there are two kinds of drone strikes, a personality strike and a signature strike. A personality strike is when you have someone like Betula Massoud, the deceased commander of the Pakistani Taliban. CIA was hunting him for years. They finally got a lock on his location. They knew it was him. They had tracked his cell phone. They had him under surveillance. They do a drone strike and they kill him. That's a personality strike. They are going after a specific individual and they want to kill him. A signature strike is something that Obama has dramatically increased the use of during his administration. Bush started to use it at the very end of his time in office. A signature strike is a drone strike where you are targeting certain regions of Pakistan and Yemen. And anyone that you kill in these strikes, you posthumously declare a terrorist or a suspected militant on the idea that there's so much terrorist activity and chatter coming from this area that the odds are these people are terrorists. So they will track someone and say, so-and-so has been on the phone with these three people who we believe are terrorists. And he went to this mosque where the imam is a guy that we believe is supporting Al-Qaeda. So we're going to track their phones. And when we find them in a certain area, we're just going to kill them, even if we don't know their names. And we don't have any actual evidence that they're involved with a crime or involved with plotting any acts of terrorism. And they just declare them to be terrorists. It's why this White House constantly says, we basically haven't killed any civilians in these strikes, because they've created a mathematical formula that always produces an answer of zero civilians killed, because they just declare them terrorists after the fact. So if you're the average person in an area of Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia, and a bunch of young people from your village were out sitting having a barbecue and they get blown up, and none of them had anything to do with Al-Qaeda or terrorism, how are you going to see the world? The U.S. appears to be a gratuitous enemy. We're driving people into the fold of some of these extremist organizations because we're killing so many innocent people. President Obama, who is a constitutional lawyer by training, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, is actually presiding over a global assassination program. And it's not about, is he worse than Bush and Cheney, or is he better than Bush and Cheney? I don't care so much about those. Those are sort of meaningless distinctions for me. And there's some way that people try to assuage their own guilt about this guy by saying, well, he's not as bad as Bush, or other people saying, he's worse than Bush ever was. The point is this. If John McCain had won that election in 2008, liberals would have been crying for his impeachment over the very things that many are cheerleading when President Obama does them. You know, President Obama, the most devastating aspect of this story for me when it just comes to the future of our country is that Obama has taken his credibility with a large swath of liberals in America and has spent it on the idea that these policies are legitimate. He has rebranded many of the most egregious policies of the Bush era and tried to sell it as somehow a new wine. But it's old wine in a new bottle. That's all it is. They say, oh, well, we shut down the CIA black sites. We're not torturing anymore. When I was in Mogadishu, I uncovered evidence that the U.S. is using a secret prison. This is under Obama, in the basement of Somalia's National Security Service, where people that are snatched in other countries in rendition operations are flown to Mogadishu and then put into the basement prison at the U.S.-funded National Security Service there, which is infested with bedbugs, no Red Cross access, no family contact for the prisoners, and the CIA is interrogating these people there. So Obama can say, oh, we're not torturing people. We don't run black sites because the Somalis are doing it. We're just asking a few questions. When I first started to report this story, I called the CIA for comment, and I said, well, I'm going to report that you have a new CIA base at the airport in Mogadishu, which I saw with my own eyes when we flew in there, that you are paying Somali militiamen $200 a month to run an outsourced kill-capture campaign against al-Shabaab, the militant group that pledged its allegiance to al-Qaeda, and that you are utilizing a secret prison in the basement of Somalia's National Security Service. And there was like this epic silence on the other end. And so the PR flack who had to talk to me, you know, they start you very low when you're from The Nation magazine. I call and I get, some junior intern PR guy, and there's this epic silence, and he says, yeah, I'm going to need to get someone else to talk to you about this. Then I get called back, and they say, someone of a higher stature calls back and says, the basic idea of this sounds right, but the way you're spinning it is we really have a problem with. So they're like, this facility that you're talking about at the airport, we have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, we had video of it. We were interviewing Somalis who were working at it, and I had other U.S. officials that had confirmed it. But anyway, the CIA is saying, oh, no, we have no idea what you're talking about there. And yes, we sometimes question terrorism suspects in cooperation with our Somali allies. Our Somali allies, as though there was anything vaguely resembling a government at that moment. By allies, they mean warlords, our Somali allies. So I get the CIA comment. They were very concerned I was going to call it a black site. I sort of preview the piece on Twitter, and I said, we're going to have this report coming out about this CIA facility at the airport and this prison that the U.S. is using. It's like about an hour or so from when we publish. And all of these corporate journalists start raining down on me saying, there's no base like that in Mogadishu, and questioning the integrity of what I'm going to report. And so I tweet back at someone from the National Review or something, oh yeah, tough guy, well, I'll put a picture up of the base. And within 60 seconds, I get a call on my cell phone from the CIA. I hadn't given them my number. I was calling them from an office line. I get a call on my cell phone. Yeah, Mr. Scahill, this is blah, blah, blah from the CIA. Yeah, about that tweet you just put up, we'd really appreciate it if you not put that picture up. And I say, you mean the picture of the base you told me doesn't exist? And for me, the lesson of that story was, how many times do these officials tell a journalist something doesn't exist, something isn't true, you're barking up the wrong tree, and they just take it. They take it as fact. Or they strike agreements with the editors of the New York Times to hold stories about NSA surveillance, warrantless wiretapping on American citizens, as they did with Jim Risen's pieces some years ago. Or making agreements to not disclose the fact that Raymond Davis, who was a CIA contractor who killed two Pakistanis in Lahore in January of 2011, the New York Times knew that he was CIA and continued to report that he was a diplomat. They knew it, and they continued to do it, and they were running cover for the White House. Now, journalists sometimes, and it happens to me, are presented with very serious moral dilemmas on what you report. I don't want to ever be responsible for someone else being killed. I do think there are at times legitimate arguments to be made for the safety of personnel. But what has happened is that so many media organizations have allowed the government to have the final word on it before they even raise a peep about it. And it's like if there was state media in the U.S., how would it look radically different from what we currently have, particularly on MSNBC, which is like one big Obama for America rally 24/7. But the reality of it is that he has put somehow or attempted to put a stamp of legitimacy on these Bush-Cheney Murder Incorporated policies. You see, Cheney and Rumsfeld are fascinating guys to study. Their entire life's work, if you just boil it down to sort of what they were about, had to do with creating a reality in the American political system where the executive branch, the White House, effectively operates a dictatorship when it comes to American foreign policy, and that the role of Congress is only to fund the operations that the White House deems necessary to protect the nation. They have been working on this project their entire lives, and Obama has helped them to realize that. His administration uses the state secrets privilege to quash any challenges to their assassination program, to stop any attempts to sue Rumsfeld and General Myers and all of the other people who were originally responsible for the torture at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo. His administration claims that it's the most transparent in history. It has been less transparent than the Bush administration. And I'm choosing my words very carefully here. They are waging a war against journalists right now. They are going after whistleblowers. The fact that the people who ran the CIA's torture program, like Jose Rodriguez, are on book tour right now, and John Kiriakou, who blew the whistle on torture, is in prison right now, says everything you need to know about where this administration's priorities lie. They are doing surveillance on journalists. They are seizing phone records. They are citing journalists in criminal indictments. They are prosecuting sources. They are going after the press under Mr. Nobel Peace Prize winner constitutional lawyer. And we need independent journalism now more than ever. These dirty wars span across the globe. At one point, the U.S. had special operations forces in 75 countries. Now, under Obama, it's risen to 120. The CIA has gone through a radical reparamilitarization, where it is in a race now with the military to produce more and more paramilitary-style forces. Assassination has become a solid central component of what is called U.S. national security policy. President Obama presided over the execution by drone of three American citizens. But this is the transformative Democrat. This is the guy who said he was going to change all of this stuff. The stakes are so incredibly high. Thank you very much.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks to Kenneth Doust, whose radio show New World Notes first put me onto the film Shadows of Liberty. And thanks too to the good folks at Doc Factory for making that film. I hope this show will help you, if you have a commercially controlled media habit, to rein it in. And I include Wikipedia in that. To see how closely that's controlled, just give it an edit. Put in some of the things you heard in Unwelcome Guests, some of these unwelcome truths. And if they're edited out quickly, don't be disappointed, but reflect on that, and perhaps head over to WikiSpooks. We're only a very small team on WikiSpooks at the moment, so if even one person decides they're going to cruise over and have a go at editing, that will be a great encouragement. Many thanks to all of you who've sent me emails over the years, encouragement, suggestions of materials and feedback. You're all an invaluable help to make this show what it is.